Radiotopia.
Welcome to the Kitchen Sisters present.
From PRX.
We're the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson
and Nikki Silva.
Hi, I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a new season. Ear Hustle is a show about life in prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at four California prisons and have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships in prison, and incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. Stories about life on the inside told by those who live it. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts. The Kitchen Sisters Present is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
In mid-1983, Prince was just coming off the 1999 tour, and he had a hit with Little Red Corvette on the Billboard Hot 100. He was happily based out of Minneapolis, but his home studio was in disrepair. He asked his management to find him a technician. My boyfriend at the time called me up right away, and he said, "Your dream job is waiting for you. Prince's technician." I said, "Well, tell them their search is over. That's my job. I'm getting that job."
I should know by the way you popped your car sideways at a wooden mat. You're the kind of person who believes in making out once, love them and leave them fast.
Today, the Kitchen Sisters present Prince and the Technician.
My name is Susan Rogers. I'm a professor at Berklee College of Music in Boston. Prior to my academic career, I was a recording engineer and a record producer. I worked with Prince for many years in the mid-80s.
Describe that first moment of the two of you laying eyes on each other.
The first time I met Prince face-to-face was about a week after I'd heard him upstairs above me. Prince was then, and always was, notoriously shy and guarded and private. He lived in a house on Kiowa Trail in Chanhassen, a typical suburban split-level home. You could enter the house by walking up the front steps, or you could just go in through the garage into a small bedroom, outfitted to be a recording studio. My first task was to pull out an old recording console and install a new one that he had just bought. I had some repairs to do on his Ampex multi-track tape machine, and I had a list of things that were broken that needed to be fixed. While I'm downstairs in that studio, I could hear him upstairs right above me on his Yamaha Baby Grand piano playing The Beautiful Ones, The Computer Blue, and Purple Rain. I could hear meetings that he was taking with members of Vanity Six and members of The Time. I could hear the records that he was playing, but I didn't see him. When I finally finished, I didn't really know what to do. I didn't just want to go upstairs and disturb him. So I called the woman who worked for him, Sandy Scipione, and I said, "Sandy, I'm done. Tell him I'm done." And next thing I knew, he came downstairs. He asked me some questions. He gave me some instructions. There was no introduction or anything. It was just, you know, "Did you do this? What about that? What's happening there?" And then he said to me, "Come back tomorrow. We'll start tomorrow." And then he turned to go back up the stairs, and something inside of me said, "Don't let it start like this." I just turned 27 years old. I left everyone I'd ever known in California to come 2,300 miles across the country to take this job. something about this didn't feel right. As he was walking away, I said, "Prince." And he stopped and he turned around on the stairs and I stuck my hand out. "I'm Susan Rogers." He looked at me and got that look on his face that I would come to know very well, where he was trying not to laugh. And he stuck his hand out and he said, "I'm Prince." So we began. And it was over 4 years that I was with him.
What happened on day two?
Oh, day two. He had me put up a tape, "Darling Nikki." And I was hearing "Darling Nikki" that hadn't been released yet. And I'd never heard anything like it. It was just this thunderous wall of presence and excitement and urgency and the idea of the lyrics, the narrative story.
"I knew a girl named Nikki. I guess you could say she was a sex fiend. I met her in a hotel lobby, masturbating with a magazine. She said, how'd you like to waste some time? And I could not resist when I saw little Nikki."
Prince's output and the high caliber of that output in that period of the 80s was rather unprecedented. Bam, 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 one song after another. That second day, he asked me to set up a vocal mic, and I did. And at any moment, I just assumed that the recording engineer was going to come in, and I was afraid this engineer is really going to be angry at me. I was a technician. Technicians repair the equipment. They don't use the equipment. This wasn't my place. But anyway, I put up the mic, and finally Prince came in and he asked if we were ready, and I said, "Yes, who's going to record it?" And he said, "You." And that's when I realized there is no engineer. I'm it. He wants me to be his technician, and he wants me to be the engineer as well. We worked long, long days. Our sessions were typically 24 hours long. Prince would do a song in a day. He wouldn't get it partly finished and then call it for the day, like normal people do. He would not stop until it was done. A day could be 24, 48 hours. My longest one was 96 hours.
At what point, or did you ever say to him, "You know, I have never engineered a thing before. I repair the equipment"?
I never let Prince know that I had no training as a recording engineer. I realized at some point that Prince knew the difference. He didn't care. He wanted someone who could facilitate his creative output, someone who could keep the world out of his way.
Led you first to begin to enter the world of sound and recording? How did your path start?
I'm a non-musician. I took piano lessons when I was a child at my parents' urging. It wasn't a good fit for me. I didn't like it. I was a born music listener. I loved records and the radio. I was aware as a child that something about this, being on the control room side of the glass, not the performance side of the glass, felt right. It took a little while before I was able to get to Hollywood. I guess I was 21 when I finally started on the path of becoming an audio technician. I realized I'd have to really know what I was doing. I'd have to really know my stuff because I didn't look like an engineer looks. It's a profoundly male-dominated profession. So I studied electronics and I studied acoustics. I studied on my own, and I was fortunate to find the good people in Hollywood who liked my enthusiasm and were willing to give me a leg up and lots of training and give me a pass behind that velvet rope. And I worked in the industry for 5 years in Hollywood, and then after that I was the studio maintenance technician who repaired the equipment for Crosby, Stills, and Nash at a studio they owned in Hollywood. I was with them for a few years, and then I got an opportunity to work with my favorite artist in the world, who was Prince.
Describe that birth of a song. Walk us through a whole song cycle.
Sometimes Prince's songs would start with the lyrics written. He'd come into the studio with a notebook, just a school binder notebook, and it's a song that he would have worked out on piano or guitar. In that case, there would be a note on the console that told me what instruments he wanted set up, his drum machine or the acoustic drums, the drum kit, what keyboards he wanted set up at the ready, plugged in, routed, because what he wanted to do is to walk in and start playing and not stop. But if it was a dance song where he didn't have lyrics written, sometimes he would just start with getting the groove. He would stand at his Lin LM1 drum machine and program the drums. He was a genius with rhythm. As soon as the drums are finished, he plays the bass part top to bottom. When he's done with that, he'll get on his keyboards or on guitar and play one instrument after the other. Midway through, he'd stop, we'd make a cassette of it, he'd go sit in his car with his notebook and he'd write lyrics. He'd come back after an hour or two, I'd have the vocal mic set up ready for him to go. It would appear that the song was in his head, at least the rudiments of it. The chord changes, the melody, and the basic rhythmic structure. Unlike most other people in the world, Prince didn't record vocals in a vocal booth with an engineer or a producer sitting in the control room. Prince needed to be alone in the control room when he recorded his vocals. When he was done with the vocal, he would just move the patch cord to the next track. He'd do his backing vocal parts. Then he'd take a break, and then I could play with the mix a little bit. The next phase is where he'd truly experiment. That's when he'd pull his keyboards around him or change his guitar parts. And that's when he would look for the final parts that were going to allow this song to turn the corner. At this stage, when it became clear what this song was, that's when it became clear whether this was a song that was destined for the vault or a song that was destined for the next album. We would print it, we'd do a single version that would be 3.5 minutes long, an album cut that would be 5 minutes long, and if it was a dance song, we'd do a 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 minute long version. We'd call it and get some sleep. Now it would be like midday the next day, get a few hours of sleep and then begin again.
When you're in the studio together and in that daily, prolific period, what's the conversation between the two of you? Is there chit-chat? What's the sound of you and he in a room?
There wasn't much conversation between us. I would sit across from him, and as he would hold the instrument, underneath my fingertips of my right hand was the remote for the tape machine. I'd be recording him, and as soon as he made a mistake, my job was to roll back and punch in to pick up where the mistake was. You have to track your artist like a leopard. You have to follow their every movement. The engineer is the caboose coming up behind that train. As soon as that musician stops playing, your role is to rewind the tape as quickly as possible, go back just enough pre-roll, then punch into the chord before the mistake.
I get delirious. Never you need lose all self-control, baby, just get still. Whiskey locked in place, stupid look on my face. It comes to making a pass, pretty mama, I just can't wait to rest, cause I get delirious.
If he got off on a tangent while playing a solo, he'd want to roll back 8 bars, 16 bars, but if it was just a small minor mistake in a rhythmic part, he'd want to roll back just 2 bars. He would nod his head when the chin would start to go up, meaning here where I'm going to come down, right before the downbeat, I'd punch into the chord.
Body gets so weak, I understand. The temperature's running hot. Baby, you got to stop. If you don't, I'm going to explode.
got in a very good mood. He was usually in a good mood. Not all days. There were some dark days, but he was usually in a good mood. But he got especially chatty once the song had turned a corner. And he knew what it was. We're done. And now it was a physical thing. His brain can take a rest. And he would invite a girlfriend or a friend or band members to come to the studio and hear what we were doing. If Prince was awake, and he was awake for most of the hours of the day back then, he would take business meetings, personal stuff, in the first few hours of the morning, but the rest of the day was devoted to making music. Often there would be rehearsal. We always had a rehearsal warehouse before Paisley Park was built. The band and the crew would be there, and we'd rehearse for hours. After shows, we would either go to a recording studio, or he would play an after party. How many people do this? Play like a 4-hour sound check, a 3-hour set, and after playing in front of 20,000 people, go to a recording studio and record all night. That's the artist he was then.
What was it in him that was so possessed, that was so lit, do you think?
I think the alternative was unthinkable. He was a kid from a poor background in North Minneapolis. I don't know. I think I had heard at one point that the only job he ever had in his life was he worked at a senior center with geriatrics, maybe when he was a teenager. He had a very loving heart. He loved people. But I think Prince was well aware that time matters. He was using this powerful engine, the engine of his creativity, this incredible brain he had, coupled with his unparalleled work ethic. All of those things he knew he had. He knew he had it early in life. So he was going to use it. He was going to run as hard as he could until the energy ran out.
To working with women and his process with women and the attitude and all that.
Prince enjoyed working with women. He enjoyed the conversation. He enjoyed us as people. It's no secret to anybody who followed his work that, of course, he loved sex. He loved women as sexual beings, but that's not all that women were to him. Prince loved outsiders. He loved people who were cut from a different piece of cloth because he was one himself. The trust that he placed in Wendy Melvoin and Lisa Coleman and all of us, Karen Krattinger, those who worked with him back in those days, Sheila E., of course, Jill Jones, he trusted us. He believed in us. In his lyrics, he always talks about an us. I loved that about him, that he didn't take a predatory view toward women. He never seemed to feel like a conqueror. He was a confident man.
You mentioned earlier the vault. Can you talk about the vault, the archive?
When I first went to work for Prince, I realized that this is going to be a tough one because he's asking me for tapes that I'd never heard of songs that he had recorded that hadn't been released yet. I started gathering up whatever tapes I could find. And then I started getting a little bit obsessive. There must be stuff out in other studios. There must be stuff at Sunset Sound and Warner Brothers Records, his label. They've got stuff. I better call them. And then I started getting even more obsessive. let me see if I can get every tape he's ever recorded. And then I needed a system for cataloging it, so I was putting it in a notebook, and the office said, well, that will never do. So they got me an early 1983-84 era IBM. As this quickly began to blossom in the garage of his home, it became clear this will not do, because Minnesota, if you haven't heard, has wild temperature swings, searing, raging, humid heat in the summer, and, you know, bitter outer space cold in the winter. We found a record document storage facility that would allow users to have 24-hour access. We began now a process of archiving Prince's tapes, putting them in these plastic bins, sealed with padlock, and stored in this storage facility. As plans started coming into place for Paisley Park Studios, a plan was to make a proper vault in the basement of Paisley Park Studios, and we did. We didn't know how many tapes were going to end up there. It was just floor-to-ceiling tapes. I left Prince in late 87. By the 90s, they could not get the door of the vault closed. People have been curious, wanting to know how much material in Prince's vault has never been heard. I don't know the answer to that question. My educated guess was that roughly a third of the material in the vault hasn't been heard. I know in the 80s there was a lot of unreleased material there, and I look forward to the day when some of these songs can be officially remixed and released. I was fortunate to be with him at a time when his energy was at its peak, at the dawn of Purple Rain, the movie and the album and the work that Prince would do that would launch him into a different stratum.
I never meant to call you any sorrow. I never meant to call you any pain.
It's a funny thing. We never know what to keep and what to destroy. We don't know it at the time because we don't have enough perspective to see it. I realized when I worked for Prince that he was important. I never imagined that a day would come when people would ask me to remember days from 35 years ago, and that an individual day would be important. Thankfully, our recorded material held the record of that work. Those of us who share our stories can tell how that recorded record came to be.
You've been listening to The Kitchen Sisters Present, stories from the flip side of history, produced by The Kitchen Sisters with Nathan Dalton and Brandy Howell. Special thanks to the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art works.
The Kitchen Sisters Present is part of Radiotopia from PRX, a curated network of extraordinary cutting-edge podcasts created by independent producers.
Thanks for listening.
Radiotopia.